the CBS News Weekend Roundup in 60 seconds.
Did you know that more and more businesses are switching to Vonage? Seems like they know something you don't know. Like how they can unify all their offices nationwide on their own private connection to the cloud. Or maybe they know they're saving tons of headaches by eliminating unwieldy PBX phone systems. Or that Vonage's award-winning cloud-based mobility solutions allow their employees to communicate from any device, including their desk phone, desktop, laptop, mobile, or tablet, keeping them connected to customers while on the go. It's no wonder so many businesses are switching to Vonage. So what are you waiting for? Don't just switch to any cloud. Switch to Vonage's award-winning cloud service. Make the switch to better. Call 1-800-5-VONAGE or visit Vonage.com and find out all you need to know about why so many businesses are switching. That's 1-800-5-VONAGE or Vonage.com. Vonage, the business of better.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, here's CBS News national correspondent Dan Rabin.
Happy holiday weekend. We hope you have a lot to be thankful for. But Thanksgiving this year includes some worries, threats by terrorists, for instance, and reminders of continuing tension between police and black communities. A cop charged with murder in Chicago. And in Minneapolis, someone opened fire on Black Lives Matter protesters. We'll report in a few moments. Later, you'll hear CBS's Chris Van Cleve on the 50 places where drivers are frustrated, often at a standstill.
Interstate 90 in Chicago around O'Hare Airport is considered the worst traffic bottleneck in the country.
And many of the worst are in Southern California. More on that later. And part of a unique documentary on CBS's Showtime. It's called The Spy Masters. All 12 living CIA directors, including George Tenet, who tells of a pre-9/11 warning to the White House by the CIA.
There will be significant terrorist attacks against the United States in the coming weeks or months. The attacks will be spectacular.
A lot more coming up on this holiday weekend roundup. But first, a Chicago police officer charged with murder for shooting a 17-year-old black teenager. The officer, Jason Van Dyke, is white. The fatal shooting happened 13 months ago. Many in Chicago wonder why the dash cam video was not released until now. The video appears to show Laquan McDonald holding a knife, spun around by a gunshot, then shot 15 more times by Officer Van Dyke. CBS News correspondent Dean Reynolds.
8 Chicago cops had pursued McDonald because he was a robbery suspect. Van Dyke said the teenager lunged at him and that he felt his life was in danger. But the tape showed McDonald moving away, not toward the officer.
Critics of Chicago's Mayor Rahm Emanuel claim he may have delayed releasing this evidence, in effect a delay in charging the cop, because of the mayor's re-election campaign.
The confrontation happened on October 20th of last year. Prosecutors received a copy of the dash cam video 2 weeks later and opened an investigation. On Tuesday, the video was made public, but only because a county judge ordered it released.
Protesters, at least at first, were peaceful as they gathered outside Chicago police headquarters. Officer Van Dyke, if convicted of first-degree murder, could face 20 years to life in prison. In Minneapolis, several men fired guns at demonstrators who held signs that said Black Lives Matter. They were protesting the killing of an unarmed African-American man by police. On Tuesday, Edgar Linares of CBS radio station WCCO reported the protests continued.
They marched several miles from the precinct where protesters had been camped out for more than a week to Minneapolis City Hall. The group wants justice for 24-year-old Jamar Clark, shot November 15th by Minneapolis police. Some claim Clark was handcuffed during the shooting. Police say Clark was reaching for an officer's gun. The large crowd grew after news that 5 protesters were shot by masked men on Monday night. 3 men are now in custody being questioned about the crime. One of the victims is Wesley Martin.
I was shot in my lower leg right here. It went right in and right out.
Edgar Linares, CBS News, Minneapolis.
Now overseas, a Russian fighter plane was shot down by Turkey, which accused the plane of flying into Turkish airspace, at least briefly, while attacking anti-government rebels in Syria. This was the first time in 5 decades that a NATO country shot down a Russian plane. A Russian pilot who escaped by parachute, his colleague was killed, was rescued by Syria's military, and then he declared he didn't hear any warnings radioed by Turkey. At the Pentagon, CBS's Cammy McCormick.
Colonel Steve Warren said the U.S. heard Turkey's warnings to the Russians.
There's no reason for aircraft to be flying where they shouldn't.
While calling it an incident between Russia and Turkey, Warren blasted the Russians for their military operations in Syria.
They are just using old-fashioned, mid-20th century technology and accuracy to sling lead around the battlefield.
President Obama declared that Russia could be part of an anti-ISIS strategy to include political moves for a peaceful transition in Syria if Russia would direct its bombing at ISIS and not at other rebel groups opposed to President Bashar al-Assad. That's tricky. Assad is Russia's ally. That was a big subject for the president of France, François Hollande, when he visited the White House on Tuesday, pushing for a stepped-up military campaign. CBS's Pam Coulter reported.
President Obama expressed solidarity with America's oldest ally 11 days after Paris was shocked by a series of attacks.
Nous sommes tous français.
Under growing pressure to do more to fight ISIS, the president insisted we will win.
It must be destroyed, and we must do it together.
But after meeting with his French counterpart, there was no major shift in strategy, and he urged allies to step up their own efforts to combat the Islamic State. Pam Coulter, CBS News, The White House.
President Obama also spoke about what he called our humanitarian duty to help desperate refugees from Syria, now a political controversy, even in the campaign for the White House.
Even as we're vigilant, we cannot and we will not succumb to fear, nor can we allow fear to divide us, for that's how terrorists win.
Let's turn to an expert on Syria at the Washington Institute of Near East Policy, Andrew Tabler. You say that President Assad's chances of staying in power have gone up, though only Russia and Iran are on his side. International talks aimed at ending the civil war have begun, though we don't yet have Assad and rebels sitting together.
It's the largest humanitarian crisis since the Second World War. There's no end in sight. The fact is, the Assad regime lacks the manpower to retake all of its territory. That's where ISIS is. The opposition is quite effective at fighting the regime, but it's atomized. And the only groups that are really effective at organizing is ISIS. And they're abhorrent to not only the West, but almost everyone else in the region.
France, understandably acting with anger after the Paris attacks, stepped up the airstrikes on ISIS in Syria and Iraq, and clearly wants the U.S. and Russia to step up those anti-ISIS efforts. That could lead to what? Just more bloodshed and warfare?
More civil war, more hitting of ISIS targets, but also there have been some reports that now we have more civilians who are showing up in hospitals in the Raqqa area. And that means that, you know, with more bombing doesn't necessarily go more precise bombing. The plan that's currently outlined by the United States, and I think still backed by the French and others, is a multi-year program. Quite frankly, no one has the troops to go into eastern Syria to take and to hold those areas.
Sometimes we hear from so-called experts and certainly from politicians, we know that ISIS has more or less a capital city in Raqqa, Syria. Why don't we flatten Raqqa? Please explain.
Well, Raqqa is 300,000 people, so ISIS controls it, but the city itself is full of civilians. So, again, it gets down to what would that accomplish? If we flattened Raqqa, it would be a huge boon for ISIS motivating and propaganda and recruiting tools. We don't want that. The U.S. doesn't want a war with Sunni Arabs. They want a war with ISIS, who has hijacked those Sunni Arab-controlled parts of Syria.
An expert on Syria, Andrew Tabler, speaking from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Andrew Tabler, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Up next, with so many Americans traveling this holiday weekend, where is traffic the worst?
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revie.
On this holiday weekend, AAA estimated 47 million Americans would be driving somewhere 50 miles or more. If you've been stuck in traffic, you've got plenty of company. Our correspondent Chris Van Cleve has a list of our nation's worst traffic bottlenecks. He reported from one of them, the Lincoln Tunnel between New York City and New Jersey.
Researchers looked at the 50 worst bottlenecks and found the amount of money lost in productivity for sitting in the traffic, more than $2.4 billion a year. And when we say bottlenecks, we don't mean rush hour. We mean spots like this that always seem to be bad.
Interstate 90 in Chicago around O'Hare Airport is considered the worst traffic bottleneck in the country. resulting in 16.9 million hours of wasted time. That's an estimated $418 million of lost productivity a year. The reason? Pure volume.
They destroyed so many neighborhoods to build it, and yet people still can't get anywhere.
Yeah, I give myself about an hour and a half to get to work.
Six of the top 10 are in Los Angeles. The Southland scores 12 of the worst traffic-stopping choke points overall. The New York City area has 9 brutal bottlenecks. The 2.6 miles around the Lincoln Tunnel results in 3.4 million hours of driver delay every year. Greg Cohen runs the American Highway Users Alliance, who did the study.
Comparing 2005 to 2015, are the bottlenecks getting worse?
It is getting worse over time. Certainly between 1982 and today, there's a lot of studies that show that traffic that once was just in L.A. is now worse than what L.A. was like back then in dozens of cities around the country.
That from CBS News transportation correspondent Chris Van Cleve at the Lincoln Tunnel in Weehawken, New Jersey. That's very close to where, allegedly on 9/11, terrorist sympathizers cheered as the towers of the World Trade Center across the river in Manhattan were burning, then collapsing. Presidential candidate Donald Trump brought up that story, saying in Jersey City, as he put it, with a heavy Arab population, there was cheering on that awful day 14 years ago. Several newspapers said that's a false rumor, but Trump insisted.
I saw them on television, and I read about it on the internet, and I read about it. So they said, oh, we can't find anything, Mr. Trump.
His staff did find one Washington Post article in September 2001 that reported some cheering in New Jersey. Trump says because there are bad people, surveillance of some mosques is necessary. Now a preview of President Obama's trip to Paris this coming week. He says in light of the mass murder in the French capital November 13th, we'll see the leaders of 150 nations defying terrorists by meeting there. The subject is climate change. Big decisions are expected.
This is Pam Coulter at the White House. The president has a tall order in Paris, saving the Earth.
We've got to come together around an ambitious framework to protect the one planet that we've got while we still can.
He went to the Everglades in Alaska this year to call attention to the impact that climate change is already having.
When you have warming taking place twice as fast here in Alaska as it is in the bottom 48 states, that is melting glaciers and blocks of ice that are raising sea levels, and you start getting an accelerated pace of climate change overall.
And he made a grand symbolic gesture ahead of the International Climate Conference, rejecting construction of the Keystone XL pipeline.
If we're going to prevent large parts of this Earth from becoming not only inhospitable but uninhabitable in our lifetimes, we're going to have to keep some fossil fuels in the ground rather than burn them.
Part of his argument, approving the pipeline would have undercut America's global leadership on the climate change issue. Administration efforts to curb the warming of the planet have been frustrated by some Republicans in Congress who, as one observer put it, view climate change as a liberal plot.
We keep hearing that 2014 has been the warmest year on record. I asked the chair, you know what this is? It's a snowball. And that's just from outside here. So it's very, very cold out.
The idea that carbon dioxide is a carcinogen that is harmful to our environment is almost comical. Every time we exhale carbon dioxide.
Former House Speaker John Boehner focused on the economic impact.
We can't do it alone as one nation. If we got India, China, and other industrialized countries not working with us, all we're going to do is ship millions of American jobs overseas.
The president got a boost for his climate change agenda when Pope Francis visited the White House in September.
Climate change is a problem. We can no longer be left to a future generation.
After decades of warning about climate change, environmentalists believe people have woken up to the dangers of a warming planet.
There's much greater public awareness and concern about the impacts and the costs of the impacts from climate change. I mean, there's been just such a series of extreme weather events, whether it's drought or flooding or typhoons.
Alden Meyer of the Union of Concerned Scientists has been working on the issue for over two decades and says the Paris conference could be a real turning point.
Hopefully, at the end of it, for the first time, we will have an agreement in place that commits all of the countries of the world to take action on climate change and make specific commitments to constrain their emissions.
Just before the meeting in the French capital, the vast majority of countries, representing about 90% of global carbon emissions, had put their commitments on the table. The contributions are not all the same, but Meyer says that's fair.
Rich countries that have benefited from fossil fuel development over the last century, like the United States, and have the capability to take action, need to take greater action than a country like Chad or Bangladesh.
Even with a deal in Paris, experts agree it will not be enough, and countries will need to further reduce their carbon emissions in the years to come. The course the world takes, Meyer says, will determine the fate of things like California's water supply.
If you take aggressive action to mitigate climate change, you are going to see a reduction in the snowpack in the Sierras, maybe in the 50-60% range. If you don't take action and sort of stay on a business-as-usual track, you could see the snowpack virtually eliminated by the end of the century.
And whether countries in the Mideast and Africa become virtually uninhabitable. But President Obama is optimistic.
We've got to do something about it. Good news is we can if we take some smart steps now.
President Obama to be in Paris at that climate conference this coming Monday and Tuesday. Our report was by White House correspondent Pam Coulter. Now, ready, set, spend. This being Thanksgiving weekend, it's considered the start of the holiday shopping season, even for buying cars. Jeff Gilbert at CBS station WWJ in Detroit reports.
It's Black Friday.
A few car companies started pushing Black Friday in a big way last year. It worked so well that Edmonds analyst Jessica Coldwell says now just about everybody's doing it.
I think when anything works in the auto industry, you see it rolled out again.
Chevy has a better way with Black Friday deals all month long.
Car companies are finding that Black Friday can be a month-long event. And this year, trends show that we're on a pace for the best November ever for car sales. Jeff Gilbert, CBS News, Detroit.
Up next, an inside look at the CIA spy masters.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
You don't have to be a retail giant or government agency to be the victim of a costly data breach. If you run a website and collect customer data, your small to mid-sized business is just as likely to be targeted by hackers. The Barracuda Web Application Firewall provides cost-effective instant security against automated and targeted attacks, making this WAF a must-have for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Web App Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/WAF.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Revie.
Now some secret history unveiled by a TV documentary. It'll be on for the first time this weekend, Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern on Showtime, a channel owned by CBS, with some repeats in the days ahead. It's called The Spy Masters, CIA in the Crosshairs. We spoke with two of the filmmakers, Chris Whipple and Jules Naudet. Jules and his brother Gideon made a terrific 9/11 documentary that was on CBS. Now the great achievement of the Spy Masters is that they interviewed all 12 living directors of the CIA, past and present. Here's Chris Whipple.
This is the story of 12 very different human beings who happen to be CIA director. And in fact, the film is really less about history than it is about ethical dilemmas. Every director faced life and death decisions every day.
So not just in the post 9/11 period. I mean, your earliest CIA director is George H.W. Bush, who had the job in 1976. Stansfield Turner from the 70s, William Webster from the 80s. They all faced pre 9/11 dilemmas.
We asked every director, what kept you up at night as CIA director? You know, Bob Gates said it was the idea that nuclear bombs could be rattling around out there, and we had no idea where they were.
Because terrorists would get nukes.
And this was during the breakup of the Soviet Union. Very, very different world, very different issues, but all of these directors faced life and death decisions, even more so now. When you think about drone warfare, when you think about the fact that since 9/11, we've been in a state of war. CIA has been a state of war. It's never been such a paramilitary organization, going all the way back to the OSS. That's what we wanted to get at, was the human dilemmas. Leon Panetta, for example, in the first act of our show, tells this riveting story about how he faced the decision of whether or not to pull the trigger on a lethal drone strike. They had a major terrorist in the crosshairs of a drone in Pakistan. Women and children were in the shot, and Panetta faced this extraordinary dilemma Would they let this terrorist get away? He had been responsible for the worst day in recent CIA history. He had been the mastermind of a bombing that killed seven CIA officers. Panetta faced the decision, do I let this guy get away, or do we accept some collateral damage?
Now, Jules Naudet, we think about the recent attack in Paris, not with nuclear weapons, with ordinary guns and suicide vests that explode. Did the director say that ordinary weapons can wreak horrible havoc in Western cities? And so even the CIA has to think about that?
The threat of a nuclear weapon or a dirty bomb is still very present, but it's more associated with the Al-Qaeda groups, which are, as they put the difference between Al-Qaeda and ISIS, Al-Qaeda is much more focused, at least from their point of view, on spectacular attacks such as 9/11, much more complicated. A nuclear strike on a bomb that would set off in Times Square is one of their big concerns. But when it comes to ISIS, they understand the fact that terror is also just as effective. For example, I think it was Portugal who said, if you shut down every train, shut down every mall, shut down every cinema, and no one goes out, it is just as effective as a 9/11.
That whole thought about whether to shut down everything comes up in your film, in the documentary, when there is warning before 9/11. That in July of 2001, you are highlighting a meeting that had been written about, but you've made it really dramatic. The White House being told by the CIA that analysts now believe Al-Qaeda has something huge planned and soon.
The warnings were chilling. They were multiple. They were well documented. And you have to rewind for context back to the spring of 2001 when George Tenet went to the Bush White House and submitted authorities to go in and conduct a paramilitary operation and take out bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. As he put it, they sent it back. They said, we don't want the clock to start ticking on this. In July, it came to a crescendo. On July 10, the head of the bin Laden unit burst into the office of the head of counterterrorism, Kofor Black, and said, boss, the roof has fallen in. They had multiple threats. Within the previous 24 hours, they had seven separate threats, imminent threats, detailed through their intelligence.
Let's hear part of your documentary, The Spy Masters, on Showtime this weekend.
We decided the next thing to do was to pick up the white phone, call the White House. We're coming down right now.
I said, Condi, I have to come see you. It was one of the rare times in my 7 years as director where I said, I have to come see you. We're coming right now.
Present at the July 10 White House meeting, our national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, and other top officials.
So Rich started by saying, there will be significant terrorist attacks against the United States in the coming weeks or months. The attacks will be spectacular. They may be multiple. Al-Qaeda's intention is the destruction of the United States.
I said, this country's got to go on a war footing now. I sort of slammed my hand on the table.
What happened?
Yeah, what did happen?
That's Kofor Black, who was in charge of counterterrorism. Before that, you heard the then CIA director, George Tenet. Excerpts from the documentary The Spy Masters, which is premiering on Showtime this Saturday. We were speaking with two of the filmmakers, Chris Whipple and Jules Naudet. Thank you.
Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Heather Bosch in a New York subway station where there are surging trains, busy commuters, the echoes of announcements.
The next Brooklyn bound train is now arriving.
And if you're lucky, violinist James Grasek, he admits there are challenges to playing this venue.
How often does this interrupt your playing?
Well, that's what it is. I have to deal with it.
Perhaps with a hasty finale.
So I'll finish it up.
And switch to an impromptu duet.
Sometime, once, every now and then, the door will close just as I'm finishing Over the Rainbow.
But why perform here, the musician who's played from concert halls to classrooms?
And I even taught in a college for 2 years. I missed New York so much that I had to come back.
What he missed...
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
...was interacting with people here.
The reason I love playing this way is because of the connection I have with my fellow New Yorkers and commuters.
It's beautiful. I love to hear violin.
Very good. It's very unique. I liked it, yeah.
It's very nice.
Playing for them within arm's reach.
You can hear that, even if it's noisy. With the most beautiful people listening.
Creating a beautiful sound for a grateful audience on a subway platform. Heather Bosch, CBS News, New York.
Please follow us on Twitter for the latest headlines at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Dan Revive.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with the correspondents who cover the news. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revive.
Woodrow Wilson, the president of the United States during World War I, considered a big peace advocate, was also president of Princeton University in New Jersey during his career, and now CBS's Michelle Miller reports a lot of campaigners on campus say President Wilson was a racist.
His name is literally etched in stone on some buildings on the campus. That doesn't sit well with some students.
People who come here, they know about his national and international policy during his time as president of the United States. But part of the problem is that his more complex history, his dirtier history, is swept under the rug.
Junior Destiny Crockett is a member of Princeton's Black Justice League.
We will be seen!
The student group takes issue with Wilson's racist past. As president, he worked to segregate federal agencies. And during his term at Princeton, not a single black student was admitted.
We've been here!
Last week, some 200 students walked out of class in protest, and about 15 staged a sit-in at the president's office. Among the group's demands, that Princeton rename its public policy school and residential college. Both bear Wilson's name. And acknowledge Wilson's racist legacy. Princeton's current president, Christopher Eisgruber, declined our request for an interview. Evan Drame is with the Open Campus Coalition, a group that doesn't believe in removing Wilson's legacy from the university.
Woodrow Wilson had these racist attitudes, and we should definitely condemn him for that. However, we should also remember that historical figures are creatures of the times in which they live.
Josh Freeman is another.
We have to respect the good and the bad when it comes to Woodrow Wilson. He's a part of this campus's history, and erasing it will not do us any favors.
We got to fight back!
The controversy at Princeton comes at a time of heightened racial tensions on campuses across the country. Earlier this month, the University of Missouri's president stepped down after African-American students, including members of their football program, complained of his inaction addressing racial issues on campus. But for Princeton students still trying to find their place in the debate, one thing is clear.
You know, it's difficult because you can't tell somebody that they should or shouldn't feel something. But I really think that, you know, his name should be used as sort of a catalyst for conversation and engaging the community.
That's one Princeton undergraduate. The president of the university agrees, writing, "We have to be open to a thoughtful reexamination of our own history." Let's turn now to a decision in Superior Court in San Francisco. A judge has ruled that 5 frozen embryos must be thawed out, then destroyed, because a woman who said this was her only chance to be a mother had agreed to do that with the man who's now her ex-husband. Mimi Lee was suing to have at least one embryo implanted in her so she could give birth. But her ex, Stephen Findley, insisted now that they're divorced, he does not want to be the biological father of her children. CBS News legal analyst Ricky Kleeman talked about the case with CBS This Morning co-hosts Gail King and Nora O'Donnell.
It's in part significant because it is California, and California is a state where people look to that state to see what is going on in the law. It's also significant because of the 1 million embryos that are frozen, 10%, 100,000 of them are frozen at this clinic. So what we have here is a clinic that has a form. And what the plaintiff, what Dr. Lee had said was, look, when I signed that form, it was merely an informed consent form. And what the defense, the person she was married to, he had said, no, wait a minute. It is called informed consent and agreement.
He wanted them destroyed, the embryos, because they're no longer together.
Not only are they no longer together, it was a very acrimonious divorce.
But some people are calling this decision harsh, Ricky, because, as you know, she had cancer, and she was saying this is her last chance. So is the court basically saying the contract trumps your desire to have children, even though you probably cannot have children anymore? That seems very, very harsh.
Well, it may be harsh emotionally, but it is not harsh legally. Because we know, I have said it many times, and I will always say it, we cannot agree in society to exist and coexist peacefully unless we have contract. We have to be able to honor our words.
The frozen embryos were stored, by the way, at the University of California, San Francisco. Now to a traveler and a writer bringing an uplifting message to fellow Americans all over this country. Corey Hudson, you have a book featuring your photographs of people who told you about their lives. The book's title is Every Heart Has a Story to Tell. Corey Hudson, what's your approach? How do you get people who have problems to talk about them?
Well, I'm looking for anyone. I look for people who radiate light. I look for people who are maybe disconnected and alone. And the first thing that I ask them is if I can take their photo. And then usually they say yes, or they say why, what is it for? And I lead into what my intentions are and follow it up with several questions. And it usually ends up being an in-depth conversation that sometimes lasts for hours. And then I've established a connection with that person that will continue for years.
When I've looked at your book, Every Heart Has a Story to Tell, those are fine portraits. Very good, considering you're not yet, you know, a full-fledged professional photographer. The interviews, they surprised me because, you know, these are people with your average kind of problems, but then it turns out horrible things happen to them at home, or the best man at their wedding committed suicide. I mean, how long do you have to spend with someone before the really difficult, painful stuff comes out?
I get right to it. The first question that I ask people is, what is the most challenging thing that you've experienced or are currently experiencing? And I think that that in itself peels away all the layers of protection and shame and guilt and all the things that we sort of protect ourselves with.
How old are you, Corey?
38.
38, okay. And I get the impression from what you've written that your teenage years, your 20s, maybe even beyond, had a lot of problems. You're right, of depression, anxiety. You became suicidal. You were hospitalized. Yet you had a job as a chef. So what should I think, that you were kind of a functioning, psychologically wounded person?
Absolutely.
And do you tell that to people? Because you're approaching them to tell their story. So somewhere along the way, do you tell them a lot about you?
I don't typically share more than they're willing to hear. A lot of people don't necessarily want to listen to my whole story. I'm more of the listener, but there's really an exchange that happens a lot of times where they let me in and I in turn let them in, and it's just a back and forth conversation of inspiring each other and connecting in meaningful ways.
Right on the back of the book is a heart, and it says, your story will inspire others. You think that's almost a sure thing if people talk about their painful memories and how they got through it?
Absolutely. Anybody's story, no matter how insignificant they think it may be, could benefit someone else.
Corey Hudson has learned that himself, as you heard, a former chef who used to have a lot of problems, now traveling coast to coast. The book is called Every Heart Has a Story to Tell. Corey Hudson, thanks, and safe travels.
Thank you so much.
And to all, a very happy Thanksgiving. Stay tuned for more news and interviews.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
When you run a small business, even the smallest decisions are stressful. What color should the logo be? Black, purple, blue? Which blue? Sky, deep, seafoam, aquamarine? But there's one decision that's easy. The decision to make your business better by switching to Vonage's award-winning cloud-based communication service. With seamless mobility between your devices so your employees can connect with your customers while on the go. With state-of-the-art tools like Virtual Receptionist, so every call is routed with pinpoint precision. And all for much less than you think. Call 1-800-5-VONAGE or go to Vonage.com to make the switch now. It's no wonder so many small and large business owners are switching to Vonage. So don't just switch to any cloud. Switch to Vonage's award-winning cloud service. Call 1-800-5-VONAGE or sign up at Vonage.com. Vonage, the business of better.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Ravine.
Young Americans starting their careers are using apps on their smartphones to save money, and that includes building up some savings for the future. CBS's Jamie Yukas reports.
Bill Conley is really watching his budget right now. He's set to move from New York to L.A. next month.
I at least like to know how far I'm overstepping my bounds.
That's why he downloaded Mint, an app that tracks how much money you have, how many bills you have coming your way, and lets you set savings goals.
You can set up alerts. If I say that I want to budget to only spend $100 a week on food, and it shows that I spent $300 this week on food, it can email me and say, what are you doing? Reel it in a little bit.
Dan Chambell is a millennial who tracks workplace habits for his generation. He sees apps becoming the popular way millennials save money, manage their budget, or even invest.
Millennials could be using multiple banks, multiple credit cards, and these apps basically facilitate the exchange of all this information and centralize it in one app.
The app Level Money will keep track of your budget and give you a look at how much money you have left to spend each day, week, and month. Acorns takes your spare change from your linked credit and debit card purchases and then rounds it to the nearest dollar. That change is then invested in six different funds.
It actually is an incentive for millennials to start saving because it's a little bit each time.
And millennials like Connolly think the apps allow him to save more by alerting him in real time.
I would forget to put money into savings if there wasn't some technology doing it for me.
Allowing him to make a move now while planning his financial future. Jamie Yukas, CBS News, New York.
What movie do you suppose will be the big hit, maybe the biggest of the year, the weekend of December 18th? Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. Almost for sure. Now, is this a George Lucas movie like the original Star Wars films? No. 3 years ago, the Walt Disney Company bought Lucasfilm. Mr. Lucas pocketed around $4 billion. Disney hired J.J. Abrams to direct and co-write this new movie. George Lucas told CBS's Charlie Rose he's kept his distance.
They looked at the stories and they said, we want to make something for the fans. So I said, all I want to do is tell a story of what happened. You know, it started here and it went there. And it's all about generations and it's about, you know, the issues of fathers and sons and grandfathers. And it's a family soap opera.
I am the father.
It's called space opera, but people don't realize it's actually a soap opera. And it's all about family problems and that kind of, it's not about spaceships. So they decided they didn't want to use those stories. They decided they were going to go do their own thing. And so I decided, fine. But basically, I'm not going to try to, they weren't that keen to have me involved anyway. But at the same time, I said, I'm not going to, if I get in there, I'm just going to cause trouble because they're not going to do what I want them to do. So, and I don't have the control to do that anymore. And all I would do is muck everything up. So I said, okay, I will go my way and I'll let them go their way. And it really does come down to a simple rule of life, which is when you break up with somebody, the first rule is no phone calls. The second rule, you don't go over to their house and drive by to see what they're doing. Yes. The third one is you don't show up at their coffee shop or the things what you're going to bring in. You just say, no, gone, history, I'm moving forward.
Filmmaker George Lucas, the man behind Star Wars, but not the new Star Wars movie coming out next month. Let's end our holiday weekend roundup with some politics to chew over. Not only the current political campaign, but an old one analyzed by Karl Rove, the well-known Republican strategist who worked in the George W. Bush White House. Rove is the author of a book called The Triumph of William McKinley, Why the Election of 1896 Still Matters. McKinley was the 25th president of the United States. He was assassinated in 1901, 36 years after Abraham Lincoln was murdered. Let's hear from analyst and author Karl Rove. He was in the CBS This Morning studio with Charlie Rose, Gail King, and Nora O'Donnell.
So what do we learn from this McKinley race?
Well, American politics in the 24 years leading up to the 1896 election looks like politics today. Mm-hmm. The political system is broken. We have divided government. We have five presidential elections in a row in which nobody gets 50% of the vote. We have acrimony in Congress that makes today look like kids' play. And we have divided government. The Republicans, during a 24-year period, control the White House, the House, and the Senate for 2 years. Democrats for 2 years. The other 20 years, divided government. We have an economy that's rapidly changing, disruptive new technologies, changing demography in the country, and the whole political system is broken. And along comes William McKinley, and in the 1896 election, we have a realignment of the American political process, and for the next 36 years, the Republicans dominate the scene. And it's one of the great elections in American history, but we don't talk about much about it. And we certainly don't talk about the prime actor in the drama, William McKinley.
Just to underscore what you just said, Republicans have lost the popular vote in five of the past six presidential elections. What is it that McKinley did differently to change the Republican base? Who did he reach out to?
Well, he modernizes the Republican Party. It's a white Anglo-Saxon party in the North. And in the South, the votes of white and black Republicans are being extinguished by violence and fraud by the Democrats. And he realizes this can't continue. And so what he does is he reaches out to the new changing demography of America. It's the first Republican president to be endorsed by a leader of the Catholic hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And he brings to Canton, Ohio, on the front porch campaign, Croatian miners and Portuguese fishermen and, you know, Ukrainian tailors. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's an amazing group of recent immigrant groups.
And they
vote
blacks, Republican. Too, Carl.
Yeah, he is the first presidential candidate of either party to openly and actively seek the support of blacks, black voters, during the primary. In March of 1895, he goes to Jacksonville, Florida, and Savannah, Georgia, and does something that no candidate has ever done before, and that is appear in front of a black audience and say, I'm running for president, I need your support.
So let's just bring this back to the Republican campaign for the nomination in 2015. If you watch that debate going on in the Republican Party, is anybody reaching out to new demographics? Is anybody reaching out?
Sure. There are lots of candidates who've got the capacity in a general election to do well among Latinos, to do well among African Americans, to do well among younger voters. Well, take a look at them. You got Bush and Rubio, who will do, the polling already shows, do particularly well among them. You look at the younger candidates, whether it is Rubio or to some degree Cruz and to some degree Kasich, and some degree Christie, who could do well among millennials. If Republicans went from getting the 5% that they normally have gotten in the age of Obama among African-American voters to the 12 or 13% that Bush got in 2004, we win Florida.
Karl Rove's book, The Triumph of William McKinley, is published by Simon & Schuster, a division of CBS. Thanks for being with us, and anytime you want to hear us, please do a web search for CBS Weekend Roundup. You'll find our podcasts also on iTunes and other podcast services, and our app for your smartphone is CBS Radio News. I'm Dan Revive. Bye.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein.